Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Is the Trump campaign at a crisis point once again? The Republican candidate has shaken up his campaign team once again, effectively the second overhaul in as many months. Did the Obama administration give away $1 billion of taxpayer money to a private corporation to administer a nearly empty detention facility designed for mothers and their children? Khalid Jabara, a 37-year-old Lebanese-American, has been murdered on his own front porch in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Racist bigotry against Muslims and Arabs and South Asian people is sweeping the country. But first, we turn to the Donald Trump campaign. Is it at another crisis point? The Republican candidate has shaken up his campaign team once again, effectively the second overhaul in as many months. As his poll numbers slip, should we expect something new from the Donald, or is this just the rearranging of the deck chairs on the Titanic? We are joined from New York City by Ted Rall, editorial cartoonist and author, including the author of a new book on Donald Trump. Welcome.
Thanks, Brian.
Donald Trump has been taking a beating in the polls as of late. Hillary Clinton lead looks to be commanding at the moment. What's behind the shakeup with the campaign team?
Well, campaigns always say that these things are a product of just moving forward into a different phase of the campaign. And that's obviously true. The Republican National Convention is over and the Trump campaign is moving into the general election campaign for real. But there's no denying the fact that Trump is getting eaten alive in the polls, with some polls showing Hillary Clinton with as much as a 14-point lead over Donald Trump. The campaign is definitely scared, and there are a lot of pundits who are already writing Trump off. And this is not a guy who likes to be characterized as a loser. So at this point, I think he's starting to take things seriously, and he's looking to blame everyone but himself for his current problems.
Well, let's look at who he actually chose. Stephen Bannon, the CEO of Breitbart News, is now the CEO of the campaign. I mean, Breitbart is going to be the leadership for the Republican Party campaign in the presidential election. I mean, talk about that.
Yeah, well, it's very clear that this the Republican Party and Donald Trump's campaign are moving to the hard right after having been hard right throughout the primary campaign. Obviously, there, as we've discussed before, there are some exceptions to that on issues of trade and certainly on foreign policy. But, you know, this, you can't escape the symbolism. Breitbart is an extreme right-wing website that is on the far fringes of American politics, even within the GOP. Now, you could say that this is a beyond symbolism. It might just simply be a management choice. But everything matters in politics. Everything is analyzed, as we are doing here. And there's no escaping the message that this is not a campaign that is going to be trying to do much to appeal to voters that are not on the far right.
Right. So the president of the United States, be he or she a Republican or a Democrat, and it's always one of those two parties, is the CEO of the U.S. state, this U.S. state apparatus of the U.S. empire. There are far-flung corporate and military interests literally in every country in the world. That person becomes the CEO, the one running the ship. Now, if you have Breitbart, which is, as you said, the ultra right, the far right, and even for the Republican Party, which is so has become so right wing, it's really outside the realm of the Republican Party. For him to pick that person, Stephen Bannon from Breitbart, as the new CEO of the campaign, it seemed to me to be like Trump saying, well, they say in the media, he's giving the middle finger to the Republican establishment. But it also means, from my point of view, that Donald Trump isn't really any longer serious about winning the presidency. What do you think?
That's what a lot of people are saying, and it's a very reasonable conclusion to draw. But I think I might finesse that a little bit by saying that he might be serious about winning, but he doesn't seem to be willing to make the changes or the moves that would be necessary in order to win. Or perhaps more cogently, this is a guy who doesn't know how to win. I think one of the best explanations that I've heard recently is simply that he doesn't want to win as someone different than he is. He would rather lose than tack to the center or adopt a more moderate tone. And I think that's probably closer to what's going on. I do think he's serious about wanting to be president, but he's not willing to make the big changes necessary. Now, that said, I think that a lot of pundits are writing off Donald Trump prematurely. And the reason I say that is because it is early. We still haven't been to the debates. I think he's going to destroy Hillary Clinton in the debates. I don't know if that will be enough to close a 12 to 14 point lead, but it should close much of it. And in these debates, facts don't really matter. Tone matters and authenticity matters, or more accurately, the perception of authenticity. Everyone in the political class these days comes off as phony, whether it's your local city councilman or the president of the United States. Donald Trump, for all of his many faults, comes off as completely and fully authentic. And I think that is worth its weight in gold in this political year or in any political year.
Donald Trump, when he started this campaign, I think his goal, and this was stated by some of the people who have left the campaign, his goal was to get at least in the double digits within the Republican campaign. It seemed to me that Trump was not really considering himself a viable candidate in the beginning. I know you may feel differently, but the campaign took off. It was a remarkable campaign year. On the Democratic side, you had Bernie Sanders' campaign really disgraced attempted to be disgraced by the Democratic Party establishment. It had no money when it started. It was marginalized. He's a 74-year-old white guy from a small rural state, the most unlikely candidate to set off a mass movement. But in fact, he did set off a mass movement. And we know now that Sanders has folded his tent. He's telling his people support Hillary Clinton. On the Republican side, though, there was a perfect storm where Donald Trump, even though if he did not intend to win the nomination, was able to do so because there were 16 candidates. None of them wanted to drop out. Super PAC money is such right now that any candidate, even those who are getting only single digits, can keep going because some super PAC billionaire says, yeah, keep going. I'll keep funding you. I mean, the entire election cycle seems to be out of sync. But right now, this seems to be a complete catastrophe for the Republican Party. What do you think?
Yeah, it does look like that now. And look, if the election were to be held tomorrow, certainly Hillary Clinton would prevail and Donald Trump would be lucky to get 190 electoral votes out of 270 needed to win. So it would be a disaster. But the election isn't tomorrow. It's we still have a few months to go. The debates are going to be absolutely pivotal. And if Donald Trump can win, it's going to be all about these debates. Now, I do think that from my research on my book, Trump, A Graphic Biography, I learned that Trump copyrighted and trademarked the phrase Make America Great Again back in 2012. And he has floated trial balloons for running a political campaign many times in the past, dating back to the 1980s. But this is the first year that he ever formally announced. And at the time, I remember telling everyone who would listen that he would be the Republican nominee the day that he announced. And the reason I thought that was it was just simple arithmetic. Here's a guy who started out with 30%-ish of the vote in a 12 to 17 to 18 man race and woman race. And so it was these other guys just split up the vote. If you have 30% of the vote in a race with more than three or four people, you are going to win. And it's surprising to me that people didn't see that. I think people are underestimating the capacity of the Clinton campaign to commit electoral suicide, the possibility of additional scandal, and a poor performance in the polls, not to mention the possibility of another terrorist attack. These days, even a relatively minor terrorist attack, such as what happened in San Bernardino, was enough to really drive Trump's campaign on national security issues. And I think that it doesn't take that much anymore to get that kind of fear-based reaction in the electorate. I don't think Trump will probably win, but I think he can. And I think there's a better chance than people are giving him.
We're talking with Ted Rawl about the Republican Party in crisis as Donald Trump shakes up the campaign team once again, choosing the CEO of Breitbart as the new CEO of Donald Trump for president. Okay, so Donald Trump, what did he do? He trademarked Make America Great Again in 2012. Is that what you said?
That's right.
Okay, so yeah, so he's branding early. He's obviously thinking about politics. Of course, first and foremost, he's thinking about himself. He's thinking about his business. He's a huckster. He's a con man. He's selling stuff all the time. He doesn't really, you know, have to come forward. He has other people leveraging the debt. He's just been able to be given a free ride. And during, Ted, I want to ask you about the media coverage, because during the primary campaign, in addition to the factors that you cited, the other factor was the media gave Donald Trump like 95% of all media coverage during the primary period. Moons, the CEO of CBS, said, this may be bad for the country, but it's great for CBS because what they're thinking about is ratings. But now as we come to the general election, when the real political establishment kicks in and the media is their mouthpiece, the media is their voice, the media is not just fascinated with Donald Trump right now. The media is trashing Donald Trump because the political establishment of the Republican and Democrats don't actually want Donald Trump to be the CEO of the American state.
No, they really don't. And they did make this monster. But far be it from me to defend mainstream corporate media. In fact, I'm in a lawsuit against a major outlet in the major corporate media, even as we speak. But the fact is that Donald Trump does jazz. And Hillary Clinton is playing the same record over and over again. And which concert is more exciting? I'll tell you. I don't need to answer that question. You know, you look at Hillary Clinton, she does every appearance, has the same stump speech. Bernie Sanders was the same problem. But Donald Trump ad-libs at every appearance that he does. At every appearance that he does, you never know what he's going to say. And that's irresistible for the press, because you know there's always a possibility, if you carry it live, that you'll be able to break some outrageous story. For example, the story from 3 days ago when Donald Trump said that he wanted an ideology test at the American border. So you just never know what's coming next. You know, with Hillary Clinton, you know exactly what's coming next. You know it, and you know it's going to be dull as dirt if you're a producer. So yeah, it's not surprising. But it is, to a certain extent, I think Donald Trump's been observing American politics as an outsider for a long time. And kind of like the early punk rockers looking at the old stadium rockers, he has managed to figure out that a lot of stuff that people take for granted was always stupid and never made sense, and he refuses to play by those rules.
Do you see in the debates, okay, he's going to debate Hillary Clinton, not a great debater. She has a tremendous baggage. She's a very, very unpopular candidate. In fact, if it wasn't Donald Trump that she was running against, I doubt that Hillary Clinton could win this general election. But again, she doesn't really have to say that much in the debates when you have, again, the Republican Party foreign policy elite is behind Hillary Clinton. The Democratic Party is behind Hillary Clinton. Wall Street bankers are behind Hillary Clinton. All of the mainstream media, perhaps with the exception of Fox News, is behind Hillary Clinton. When you have that kind of power lineup in America, Donald Trump, even if he's, you know, somewhat interesting, even if the media wants to pick up and say, you're jazz, you're not, you know, boring. Again, there's relentlessly bad media coverage. And then you have Trump himself, who is such an unabashed bigot that right now the latest poll shows that he has 1% of the black vote in America. I mean, you really can't win the presidency with 1% of the black vote or such low single digit votes from the Latino community. I mean, America is not the same America demographically as it was, say, when Ronald Reagan was elected.
I agree with everything you just said, Brian. I think that's totally right. I think, however, I do think that there's no underestimating how poor a performance we can expect from Hillary Clinton in those debates. I mean, American political debates are about entertainment first and foremost. This format was made, tailor-made for Donald Trump. And I either don't believe or don't understand reports that say that Trump was reluctant to debate Hillary Clinton. If I were him, I'd ask for 17 debates, because at the Republican debates during the primaries, it was like he was the only guy on the stage among the other nine at the upper ticket debate. And I think it'll look a lot like that this time. He doesn't care that she's a woman. He's not going to be chivalrous. He's going to beat her up. And he's going to call her out on a lot of her inconsistencies and her hypocrisies and her scandals. Some of the stuff will stick, others won't, but it's must-see TV. Everyone's going to be massively entertained. And I think it's while it's true that he has the entire media and corporate elite lined up, aligned against him, he also still has that base of the Republican Party, which guarantees him 40 to 45% of the vote. So what we're really talking about is the 8 to 10% of swing voters who are in play. They are going to decide this thing. And the question is, are they going to come away thinking that Hillary Clinton is hapless, or are they going to think, okay, we have to elect the adult in the room, the one who uses drones? I don't know. I can't say, but I think it's not going to be as if Hillary Clinton wins, it's going to be a far closer race than it is right now.
Very interesting. And of course, Hillary Clinton's email scandals and what they show, and the fact that we now know that the Clinton Foundation received literally tens of millions of dollars from states, including states that were negotiating with the State Department while she was the Secretary of State. The fact that that hasn't really become a gigantic story, again, also really is to the disadvantage of Trump, to the advantage of Hillary Clinton. We'll see how that all plays out. We've been talking to cartoonist and author Ted Rawl. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. And Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Khalid Jabara, a 37-year-old Lebanese American, was murdered on his own front porch in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Despite a history of racist harassment and violence, authorities appeared to have refused to intervene at several critical points that could have saved Jabara's life. To discuss this tragic development, we are joined by the Council on American Islamic Relations, Oklahoma Civil Rights Director Veronica Lazure, and Robert McCaw. He is the Director of Government Affairs at the Council on American Islamic Relations here in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Veronica and Robert.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Veronica, let's talk about what happened in Oklahoma. Khalid Jabara's neighbor had a history of abusing him and his family with anti-Muslim slurs, even though Jabara was actually Christian. Is it common for Islamophobia to spill over to affect people, including people who are not Muslims, but who are perceived to be?
Yes, unfortunately, we definitely see that the Sikh community in particular has suffered some pretty horrible crimes just because they're perceived to be Muslim. And Arab Christians are often the target of anti-Muslim and anti-Arab hatred as well.
Robert McCaw, this killing takes place, of course, in the context of the recent months of campaigning Donald Trump, but not just Donald Trump, a number of the other candidates in the Republican Party were using the Muslim American community as a punching bag. Of course, Trump was the most extreme, calling on Muslims to be banned, but Ted Cruz said Muslim neighborhoods and mosques should be patrolled, et cetera. Not that they're not already. But talk about how the social political environment plays into something like this, because, of course, in the media, there's also the description of each act of violence, like the killing of Jabara, as a lone wolf person who's just psychologically, mentally, emotionally unstable.
You know, political words definitely can be translated into the actions of political followers. We've seen that the Republican Party has become the political epicenter of Islamophobia. Just this week, Donald Trump has announced that the U.S. has a new Cold War, and it is against, quote-unquote, radical Islam. And Trump has also made prior statements generalizing that the religion of Islam has a hatred within it, that Muslims have hatred within their hearts, that Muslims have cheered on 9/11. Trump and the Republican Party, we're seeing our mainstreaming Islamophobia. They are heightening tensions in the communities, and it is definitely related to this recent uptick in violence against Muslims in their houses of worship.
Veronica, you are in Oklahoma where the killing took place of Khalid Jabara. Talk about the situation in Oklahoma, in the Midwest, for Muslims, Muslim Americans, Arab Americans, South Asians. What's it like? What's happening?
Well, unfortunately, in the past year or so, we have seen an increase in anti-Muslim harassment and discrimination complaints. But here in Oklahoma, at least, we're very fortunate to enjoy healthy relationships and open communication with law enforcement agencies. as well as great collaboration from our interfaith and social justice community partners. For every hateful phone call we get, for every nasty tweet, we get dozens of messages of support and encouragement saying, we love what you're doing. We love our Muslim colleagues and friends. We love our Arab American neighbors and sisters and brothers. And I think that that's really encouraging. I think the Southern spirit of friendliness and inclusion really does allow for positive relationships and positive growth here.
You know, we're here in Washington, D.C., both Robert and I'm in a studio in Washington, D.C. In many ways, the United States, being such a big country, such a geographically diverse entity, it's hard to know really what things are like in other parts of the country, which we don't visit. Like, we don't go to Oklahoma very much, people in Washington or people on the coast. But how many Muslims, how many Arab Americans, how many South Asian people are in Oklahoma? How big is the population? And how does the community work together? Is it simply around religious organizations or mosques, or is there some other sense of community that's manifested?
Well, I can really only speak to the demographics of the Muslim population because that's primarily who I work with. But our most recent estimates are that there are around 35,000 Muslims living in Oklahoma, which is about 1% of the Oklahoma population. And while CARE Oklahoma primarily works with people of the Muslim faith, we do also frequently partner with interfaith organizations. And I think we've had a lot of great success in bringing people together sort of cross-culturally, cross-religiously, and across all these different boundaries so that we can try and work on improving things in our state.
Robert McCaw, CARE, the Council of American Islamic Relations, is the largest Muslim advocacy organization in the United States. You're dealing with people's problems, the needs of that community all over the country, so you have a good sort of sense of it, of the big panoramic view. One of the most infuriating things about this case, the killing of Jabara in Oklahoma, is that it seemed like authorities could have intervened to save his life, but did not. Stanley Vernon Majors, who was arrested for the murder, intentionally hit Jabara's mother, Haifa, with his car a year ago and broke her shoulder. He was released on bail despite prosecutors saying he posed a substantial risk to the public. The Jabara family said in their statement, yet in May, not even 1 year after he ran over our mother, he was released without any sort of accountability, no electronic ankle bracelet or anything. And even earlier in that day, Jabara himself, Khalid Jabara, the victim, had called the police and warned that this man had a gun. I mean, are the police, are law enforcement agencies generally responsive, unresponsive when people are trying to contact them, alert them to possible dangers?
I would say that generally law enforcement is responsive. CARE puts out a community safety manual for securing houses of worship. And one of those suggestions that's included is making sure they have good relations with their local police, making sure the police know how to make rounds surrounding the mosque and that they're familiar with the area. Obviously, there are going to be incidences where the police aren't fully doing their job, where they're not taking threats serious. And it's definitely not the fault of the victim for not having a relationship like that. And definitely something like this could be investigated.
Well, Veronica, let me go to the specifics, the particularities there in Oklahoma. 30 minutes prior to his murder, Jabara, as I said, called the police when he saw Majors, the alleged killer, brandishing a gun. Astonishingly, the Tulsa police said in a statement, officers arrived at the location where he was eventually killed and were unable to locate any criminal activity. Officers then left the scene. Is it common for police or other law enforcement authorities to not take reports of Islamophobic violence or the threats of violence or intimidation seriously? What's your own experience with this?
Well, we have worked very hard, both in the major metropolitan areas of Oklahoma City and Tulsa, to foster really positive relationships with law enforcement. And so our sense in looking through the facts is really not that Tulsa police dropped the ball. I mean, if they had gone to Major's house and he refused, for example, to let them into his home, absent a warrant or the fear that someone is in imminent danger of being hurt or the victim of a crime, they couldn't have gone in. The same Fourth Amendment that protects all of us from unreasonable search and seizures also applies to people like Majors. And so I want to stress that at this time, there's really not a sense of blame that we want to place on the Tulsa Police Department. If the system failed the Jabara family, I think there were failures all along the process that happened well before the events on Friday night.
Robert McCaw, the Jabara family had also repeated that Majors, the individual alleged to be the shooter, would frequently use also anti-immigrant and anti-black slurs, not just anti-Muslim or anti-Arab slurs. Talk about how the different forms of racism and discrimination, religious and racial profiling, how those come together. I mean, in other words, is it something, is there a pattern that you see in your position with CARE that the anti-Arab or anti-Muslim racism or discriminatory behavior is connected with other forms of racism?
Well, at CARE National, we have a saying that all anti-Muslim bigotry, it's the same hate, and that Muslims are the new target. When we look at this election, we see candidates like Trump going after immigrants. Now, whether they're Hispanic or they're Muslim or, you know, other ethnic communities, they're being targeted because they're being perceived as other. And this happens in the case of police shootings across the nation. We see that persons of color generally are perceived as a greater threat than maybe their white counterparts. This definitely also translates into the violence that we see against individuals like Trayvon Martin, where you have a community watch leader targeting someone because they're African American. And you also will have individuals in this case who really just, they don't see whether a person's Muslim, they just see that they're brown. And that's good enough to focus their hate. And so, yes, the nation is crippled with dealing with the issues of racial profiling and hatred. And it takes many different forms. And in this case, it took a very sad turn.
Veronica, I want to ask what the level of incidents or reported incidents of discrimination or racism or religious attacks are going on since, say, the year 2016, when, of course, as we've talked about, Trump, Ted Cruz, the other Republicans in particular, have made the Muslim American community such a target, such a punching bag, such a focus for their own political agitation. Have you seen, in spite of all of the grassroots efforts that you've talked about, where you see a lot of progress, have you seen an uptick in this atmosphere of incidents in Oklahoma?
Yeah, unfortunately, I can definitely say that we have an increase in complaints over last year's data. The most frequent cases that come across my desk are employment related, so people who are denied their reasonable religious accommodations in the workplace, or who are facing workplace harassment, or who are, you know, not hired, or who are wrongfully terminated because of their faith. And I also see, unfortunately, a lot of cases of issues in schools with bullying and harassment, even coming from teachers and administrators, which is very, very troubling. And I have seen kind of an increase in reported harassment and threats made in public, and people just, you know, trying to go about their jobs and their lives. So we're tracking that data very closely, and it's definitely an area of concern for us.
So what do kids do in school, for instance, if they're being bullied? Of course, if they're being bullied by other kids, which is, not unusual, presumably you can go to an adult, you can go to a teacher, you can go to an administrator, you can go to the principal or a guidance counselor. But you're saying that you're noticing bullying coming not just from other kids, but from adults.
Right. We've had a couple of very sad cases where adults will either sit back and let the harassment take place, or they'll say problematic things about Muslims, singling out the Muslim student in their classroom. And the first steps for us are really to encourage the student and their family to document every instance of the harassment or the bullying as it occurs, so that we have a clear record of if things happen, when they start to escalate. We have a clear idea of the details of the situation. And then it really is a matter of going up the chain of command and discussing it with that particular principal and administration, or that particular school district, or that particular school board. And we're also working on the other side to bring some trainings to local school systems that will help them understand the needs of their Muslim students and families. And we hope to stop some of that discrimination even before it starts. Like just last year, we had a very, very successful program at a local elementary school introducing the Muslim faith and the realities of Oklahoma Muslims to teachers and administrators. And we got so many positive reviews. We had many teachers come to us and say, you know, I was laboring under all these misconceptions, but you have really opened my eyes. Now I feel like I'm able to do a better job educating all of my students. And so we kind of work on both sides after this group of discrimination occurs to try and come to a resolution. But we also work to try and make sure that we can stop it before it even starts.
Robert McCaw, we're talking about the killing in Oklahoma, the killing of Khalid Jabbar, a Lebanese-American Christian, as it turned out. But there was also very dramatically the killing of the imam in New York City and his aide. We don't know yet all the details of that killing, but certainly the Muslim community from many different ethnicities and nationalities came out into the streets in very large numbers because the community in New York City, too, in this big East Coast city, not Oklahoma, highly sensitive to the possibility that it could be part of an anti-Islamic wave, what we've been talking about, given the social, political, and campaigning atmosphere that's been created in the United States. Talk about that, if you would, in the last 2 minutes that we have.
Yes, well, you know, it was horrible news this week where we saw Imam al-Udin Akonje and his associate Tara Udin Mai, that they were executed in broad daylight on the street. Obviously, this has mobilized the Muslim community in New York and nationwide to really assess what the threat is on the street. And just to pivot towards politics for a second, the same week that this broad daylight killing occurred, we saw New York GOP Senate candidate Wendy Long issue several tweets saying that the conversion of a Catholic church into a mosque had brought crime into the neighborhood and that Muslims were drawing crime, prostitution, and money laundering. And so you have this dynamic of anti-Muslim hatred on the street translating into violence and signaling from political leaders that, you know, Muslims are somehow less than human or a criminal element. And just with this time that I have left, I have to say we as a nation really have to reassess and do some soul searching, because, again, I think that anti-Muslim political rhetoric is leading to violence on the street and it makes the community feel less secure.
Veronica Lazier, I'm going to give you the last word. We have about 45 seconds left. Of course, ISIS and the extremist and terrorist organizations like to present their struggle as a struggle about the clash of civilizations, the inability of Muslims and Christians and Jews, people of various faiths, people of different cultures and languages to get together, to be together. You're trying to do and present just the opposite. But the anti-Islamic sort of demonization that goes on actually plays straight into the narrative of those kind of terrorist organizations. Just about 30 seconds.
Sure. I mean, making Muslims feel like they're not a full part of American society is dangerous for a number of reasons, not least because it isolates young children and it makes their communities less able to get help when they need it. We really need to be focusing in our individual homes on broadening our horizons, on learning more about our Muslim neighbors and brothers and sisters and friends, and trying to foster that spirit of inclusion and diversity that I know is really deeply part of the fabric of American culture.
Okay, that was Veronica Lazier. We were also joined by Robert McCaw. Both of them are with the Council on American-Islamic Relations. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Did the Obama administration give away $1 billion of taxpayer money to a private prison corporation to administer a nearly empty detention facility? The mass detention of Central American asylum seekers in 2014 was declared illegal by the Supreme Court. But by then, the ink was already dry on a big contract signed between the government and the Correctional Corporation of America. To help us understand how this could happen, we are joined by Margaret Winter. She is the former associate director of the ACLU National Prison Project. Welcome, Margaret.
Hi.
Margaret, you've litigated prison and jail reform cases in federal trial and appellate courts around the nation. You've argued and won prisoner rights cases in front of the Supreme Court. Help our audience wrap their heads around exactly how this took place in a deal struck by the government and the Correctional Corporation of America. Are taxpayers paying for a nearly empty facility?
Well, the big picture here is that when large numbers of families, primarily women with their children, began arriving in the U.S. seeking asylum, from the huge rise in violence in Central America, particularly in Guatemala and El Salvador and Honduras, the Department of Homeland Security And the Obama administration did what one might call a sort of a publicity stunt, something that they called an aggressive deterrence policy, of deciding that they would do a complete turnaround on their amnesty, on their asylum policies. Previously, when families would come in seeking asylum from brutality or oppression in other countries, the policy was that these families would be housed in the communities where they landed. They wouldn't be put into prison. But the administration made a deal with Corporation CCA, the biggest private prison for profit business in the world, I believe, that they, for $1 billion contract, a real sweet, sweet, sweet deal, whereby CCA would get $20 million a year, a $1 billion deal overall to operate a facility. It didn't matter if the facility turned out to be full, empty, half full. The money was going to come in anyway. And so that's the deal.
Right. So in 2014, when there was that surge of women and children from Central America coming into the United States, there was a decision made by the Obama administration basically to lock people up. In other words, to put them in these facilities. And CCA, a private profit-making corporation that makes huge amount of profit from the incarceration of people, got a contract. And that contract then was supposed to allow that all of these women and their kids could be housed somewhere. This would be the prison before they would be eventually sent back to Central America. But then what happened?
Well, not necessarily sent back. They're asylum seekers. They could very, very well be granted asylum. They have a legitimate fear of oppression in the countries that they're coming into. So now we have this contract, and there have been court decisions that it's federal court decisions that no, it's not legal to have prison for children as a deterrence to asylum seekers, and that this facility in Dilley, Texas, can only be used short term while these people are being processed, while they're being held and processed for their asylum hearings.
So a federal court granted an injunction, if I understand you correctly, that said this policy of mass detention was not legal. And that then just help the audience who's not following the sort of trajectory of events closely, how that then became an empty facility or largely empty.
Well, it varies from day to day how full the facility is or how empty it is. It sounds like for a good part of the time it's half full, and sometimes it's completely empty. I think the real point is here that what's going on, the bigger picture, is that this immense prison-for-profit industry is really a driving force, a motivating force behind governmental policy on immigration and on incarceration. There is a drive. There is an industry that is very, very hungry for profit and in the business of locking people up. And so this business, which has multi-million dollars that it funnels into lobbying and into electing candidates, is helping to decide, is playing a very big role in deciding what immigration policy and criminal justice policy should be. And their whole drive is the more people who are locked up, the better. So we see that played out in a very dramatic form in the family detention arena, but it's played out all around the country in state and federal facilities where this profit drive has played a very big part in the era of mass incarceration that we're now in the United States.
That's Margaret Winter, formerly with the ACLU. Margaret, okay, I understand that the private profit-driven prison apparatus, the prison industrial complex, so to speak, has an incentive to lock people up. They're kind of a, I don't know, I wouldn't call them a vulture corporation because the vultures live off of the dead. They're living off of the living, but the detention of the living. But why did the Obama administration skip the standard public bidding process between these different prison corporations in the case of this contract? Why did CCA be able to avoid the so-called bidding war between these vulture corporations, misnamed? And what does the process usually look like?
Well, the usual process, the way it's supposed to be, is that there's a request for bids that goes out publicly, and it says, here are our requirements. You need to provide this, that, and the other thing, and tell us what you're going to provide and what you will charge for it. And then supposedly there's an independent review of the different bids that come in, and the one that's most in the public interest and that fills the bill, that's the one that's chosen. The excuse that was given in this case for a no-bid contract was that this was such an urgent situation with all of these kids and their moms coming across the border that we needed to, in a big hurry, show the, a demonstration of force. We're going to lock them up. And this was supposedly going to stop the flow of asylum seekers from Central America. Of course, it didn't, because what was driving that influx of people, that surge of women and children from Central America, was the horror of what was happening to them with the drug wars and the gangs. They are fleeing from rape and murder. And so the suddenly putting this new lock 'em up policy into effect in the United States did not significantly affect the number of people desperately trying to enter as asylum seekers.
The basic rights of asylum seekers, and they have rights, are enshrined both in national and international laws. They vary in some cases from country to country or region to region, but they exist. I mean, how is it that the Obama administration can say to these asylum seekers, women and their kids coming from Central America, well, even though you may have legal rights, we're just going to make an example out of you? In other words, treating them as an aggregated whole, treating them as they're not, in fact, individuals. We're going to make an example out of them to deter other families from possibly following their same footsteps and coming to the United States. I mean, how is that not a violation of national and international law?
Well, I think the federal courts have agreed with you and would agree with you. The deterrence is not a justification for imprisoning people, let alone for imprisoning kids. No, that's not acceptable policy.
Margaret, you had mentioned the fact that the private prison industry has grown a great deal. How many private prisons are there, and what percentage of all prisons do they account for in the United States?
There are something approximately, I think, 150 private prisons. The proportion of prisoners in the United States that they represent of the federal prison population, it's about 12% of the overall federal prison population, which is about 200,000 people. But the total number of people locked up today in the United States in this era of mass incarceration is 2.2 million. That's including state and local lockups. So the federal is only a, 10% of the whole. Of the federal immigration detention facilities, private prison contractors hold, I think, more than 50% of them. But, you should keep in mind that of this vast prison population in the U.S., the great majority of it is in state facilities, and the private prison industry is very heavily into the state facilities, too. And that's a very, very big business. And this deal that CCA got in the federal system of we get paid even if there's nobody in our facility. Well, that's something new and shocking in the federal system, but it's actually commonplace in the state prison systems. When CCA and the other big corporations go into the states, they say, you've got to guarantee us that this prison's going to be 90% full at all times, or 60, 70, 80, 90, or 100% full, usually 90% full. It's either full or you, the state, have got to pay us anyway. And so this is part of the big boondoggle that private prisons represent.
Is that what's known as lockup quotas? Is that what that is?
Yeah.
So in fact, the government takes responsibility for locking up a certain number of people in order to satisfy a contract with a prison that's run solely for profit. In other words, investors invest in CCA or other private prisons, not for rehabilitation, not for society's good, but to make a profit, the way all investors invest. They do it for profit. And then there's an incentive and a guarantee that a certain number of people are going to be in those prisons.
Absolutely. It's a very, very sweet deal. But as you say, there is no reason for private prison corporations to be in the business of locking people up except to make a profit. And they do not make a profit unless enough people are locked up. That's one of the things that's driven this huge prison population in the United States, which is bigger, both in relative terms and in absolute terms, than in any country in the world, including China. It's staggering and out of all proportion to the rest of the world. And the private for-profit prisons have played a decisive role in driving up that population. They've been an integral part of it. That private prison industry grew up alongside of and was part of this huge surge in prison population over the last 25 years or so.
The United States lectures the rest of the world about the great wonders of the free market, as if the free market is synonymous with freedom. But you have prisons being built to incarcerate people, regardless of whether society needs to incarcerate that many people. And now we have a situation where I think you said 2.2 million people in the United States are locked up. The United States has 5 or 6% of the world's population, but 25% of the prisoners in the world. That's what I think the numbers are.
Yes, it's something like that.
If this was happening in another country, like in China or North Korea or other countries that are routinely demonized by the Western media, this would be like a number one scandal that private corporations are benefiting from, making profits off the locking up of people, that they set quotas for the number of prisoners who must be in detention. How come there's so little really outrage in the mass media?
Well, you know, it's interesting, but this issue, which really is a profound one, it really has deep implications for our whole society, is finally getting noticed. It is getting attention. Bernie Sanders put it, you know, way high up on his agenda during his campaign, during the primaries. As a result, Hillary Clinton put it on her agenda. As the sort of scandalous facts and the, you know, intrinsic horror of incarcerating people for profit has begun to come out into the public view, there has been more and more public attention paid to the issue. And I find that almost universally, when people come to grasp what this system is really all about, of incarceration for profit, people recoil in horror. So I really think that for the first time in the last quarter century that this crisis has been building, this horror has been building, there is now growing public awareness, attention being paid by the media, mainstream politicians now saying, no, this is unacceptable.
Margaret Winter, let me ask you in our last 30, 35 seconds, what should President Obama, who has said that he wants to roll back the prison industrial complex, he wants to reduce the number of prisoners, what could he do right now in his last months in office to turn this situation around? Does he have executive authority to make a change? 30 seconds.
The most important thing he could do would be to declare unequivocally that the incarceration of people for profit is wrong. He should ban it in the federal prison system, and he should make a moral call to the nation to end it throughout the federal and state system.
Yes, he has the ability, the power, and the authority to do just that. Well, that's all the time we have. We want to thank Margaret Winter. She is the former associate director of the ACLU National Prison Project. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.